Okay, we're moving on to the Enforcement Committee report. I turn it over to Terry and Lou.
In the packet for enforcement, tab 11, there's a number of things, but the second to last thing before the NOAA Fisheries Enforcement Report is a letter, a draft letter to Mr. Robert Hogan, the Office of General Counsel. And this letter is the results of the consensus of the committee at the last meeting, which is exactly as printed here, is also in the report. Second to last page. But these items were the major, or were the recommendations for the committee to be made as comments by the council on the proposed penalty schedule policy.
Terry.
Yeah, we don't have a PowerPoint, if you refer under tab 11, document 4 in your binders, there's a draft letter that the committee worked all day on, well, not all day on, but all afternoon on at our enforcement committee. There are a few things in it that in the new enforcement penalty schedule that the committee felt needed some advice on, and I think Joe Peckworth is here to answer any questions about the actual penalty schedule. I think the main theme of the conversation was around discretion by law enforcement to issue fines, leaving it up to human nature, if you hire a crewman on your boat, a violation that he has had on another boat comes over to your boat, and if he's caught for the same violation, that's considered your second violation. And so we thought that should be taken that should be taken out of the penalty schedule altogether. So I don't know if everyone has had time to read that draft letter. I could take questions on it, or Joe could take questions on it from the law enforcement aspect of it. So,
any questions for Terry or Joe? Lou? John?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up with what Tim Alexander said. I'm a member of the Enforcement Committee, so I was there throughout the thing. And just in the interest of full disclosure, I've defended many people in the fishing industry on some of these violations. Don't do it anymore, but based on the experience I have. In fact, Mitch and I tangled in a few cases over the years in our prior roles. But it was a summary settlement, so that's which is a good segue into what I want to say. I want to give a kind of a big picture approach just to prosecutions as generally, and then narrow it down to this. In all other aspects of the federal law, we're trying to allow people to get employment. We've got CORE reform bills in different states and at the federal level, so we're trying to encourage people with prior bad acts to be employed. Okay, that's point number one. Number two, on applications for employment, I know in Massachusetts at least, you can only ask the question, have you been convicted of a felony? You can't ask any other questions. It's a violation of the labor laws. So I think these are issues at the outset that we've got to be concerned of in adding this into the penalty schedule. Number three is just the reality of this, and based on my experience, a lot of these cases, particularly with crew members, are settled because they don't want to go through the process of an administrative hearing or a negotiation. The downside is a much larger fine than they may get. Those that have seen these NOVAs say just around $10,000. If you sign now, it's $3,000. or $5,000 if you sign now. It's a warning or a summary settlement. So for purposes of these prior violations, the summary settlement of signing off is considered a prior offense. So that crew member now goes to boat number two. That summary settlement, which he may have entered into simply because he couldn't afford or didn't want to hire a lawyer, is now tagged on the next owner if there's a second violation. I think that's way overreaching on this, and in fact is in the opposite of every other component of the law that we're trying to encourage people to get employed. So if you're owner two, I don't think you can even ask that question, okay, under labor law. But I just don't see how you can have this tail following the crew member. So I strongly urge those. I know the letter indicates that, but it's a real issue. These summary settlements should not be considered priors. I don't even think they should be considered priors for offense by a vessel, but that's a different discussion. But on this particular narrow issue, I don't think we should have that be part of the regs. Thank you.
P.K.
Yeah, Terry, I have a question for you. On the draft letter on the second page, under the bullet under Appendix 3, where it talks about mobile gear damages to unmarked fixed gear, could you explain that a little bit more? Because it says in a severe case that could be penalized at the same level as a level 4. Could you explain that a little bit to me?
I could, but I think it would be better come from Joe, because this is Joe's penalty schedule.
You're on the spot, Joe.
I don't want to take too much credit for it, but there are two offense levels for damaging gear or stealing gear, and the offense is at level 1 if the damage is under $2,000. It's offense level 4 if the damage is over $2,000. I think it's important to keep in mind is that the violation in that case, the specific violation of the Magnuson Act, at least requires that the violation be negligent. So if you're a trawler and you run into unmarked gear, for instance, I wouldn't say, and you damage that gear, I wouldn't say that was negligent because it was unmarked. You had no way of knowing where that gear was. So I don't even know that you'd be charged with a violation under the specific Magnuson Act provision that penalty schedule relates to. That is not necessarily clear, though, in the penalty schedule, and it's perhaps something we should consider clarifying. So I would hope the council would include those comments that we discussed at the Enforcement Committee.
Mary Beth.
On that particular issue, where does intent come on that? I mean, in certain parts of the ocean, there's an awful lot of gear. And if you're a mobile person, a mobile vessel, using mobile gear and this, fixed gear, it can be quite difficult. So is intent part of the calculation here?
Certainly. I mean, the culpability is something that the agency is required to consider whenever it imposes a penalty. The way we do it under the penalty schedule is we look at whether we consider the violation unintentional, whether we consider it negligent, whether it's reckless, or whether it's intentional. The specific gear violation that we're talking about requires a culpability of at least negligent. So we would look to the surrounding circumstances of the violation to determine what the culpability of the violator was. If they chose to work in an area where there's a lot of marked gear and ended up plowing into that gear, I would say that violation could be assessed as negligent, yes.
Question, John?
Yeah, Joe, just one question on the labor law issue. I know we discussed this at the committee level, whether you think, or I know not wanting to pick, whether we need to look into that component of, I think it's illegal for a boat owner to ask somebody if they've got a prior civil violation under mass labor law. You can only ask felonies.
Thank you, John. I think I'm not an expert in federal labor law, and I haven't had an opportunity to run that issue down. I hope it's something the council comments on so we do, as an agency, have the opportunity to run that issue down. And I also would like to just quickly address the issue of prior violations and how we're approaching that under the current penalty policy and how we're proposing that to treat priors under the new penalty policy. Under the current penalty policy, the agency considers all priors. Under the new penalty policy, we're only proposing to consider prior violations that were finally adjudicated within the last 5 years. The agency, by law, is required to consider someone's history of prior violations when it assesses a penalty. And the penalty policy is our effort to try to find a consistent, fair, and reasonable way of doing that. A lot of this is discussion that we had at the Enforcement Committee surrounded the issue of how you impute a prior to a vessel owner when a vessel operator has a prior from another vessel. And what the penalty policy says is that the prior violation may be imputed to the new owner if the new owner doesn't exercise due diligence regarding the prior violation. And the proposed penalty policy also gives an example of how a new owner could exercise due diligence. They could ask about the prior violation and require certification from their employees that they don't have a prior violation. That is not, in my view, and this is something I mentioned to Ellen earlier and something we've been talking about internally at the agency, is there are other ways to exercise due diligence when you hire someone with prior violations. And what we're trying to get at with this policy is not to make it harder for the guy who has been previously punished and who has been successfully deterred from committing future violations from getting a job on a vessel that is owned by diligent people. We want to stop bandits who are going to continue to violate the law no matter what we do from getting jobs. So what I'm thinking here, and again, I hope the council comments on our prior policy, is that the policy should provide some additional guidance regarding how you can hire someone with a prior and show appropriate due diligence. And an example off the top of my head would be providing additional training or supervision to that person that you hire with a prior violation. And that isn't to say that you ultimately couldn't be held responsible for a subsequent violation that they commit on your vessel, just that the penalty wouldn't be higher if you've shown due diligence regarding how you hired that person, how you trained that person, how you supervised that person because of their prior on a different vessel.
PK.
Yeah, going back to the gear damage, though, a little bit. What makes me a little nervous is, you know, for years it's been a gentleman agreement between lobstermen and trawlers. And with less trawling happening, you know, the lobster gear is moved everywhere. And the problem I see with, you know, what your interpretation of intent could be, I mean, if a trawler shows up, you know, where he's historically fished in the middle of the night on an edge, and, you know, all of a sudden there's marked gear there, but it might be, you know, he might think it's going up on the bottom, and I tell you, nowadays it's not. It's going the other way. It's going all the way out over the mud bottom. And if you, as a trawler, like I say, have historically fished there and set your gear out and get into a few trawls, I mean, on the trawler's point of view, that's not his fault, that's not intent. But on the lobsterman's point of view, I bet it is, you know, or he at least thinks it is. So, you know, that's just going to be a tricky, you know, how you enforce that.
Yeah, gear conflicts are definitely a tricky issue. We're going to look at all the facts and circumstances before we make an assessment of what someone's culpability is, and if those facts that you raise are relevant to that consideration. Every case is going to be different, but you know, if something's at night, something's on traditional trawling grounds, this is the first time lobstermen have entered this area. Traditionally, they don't fish this area. Those are considerations we would look at when assessing whether or not to make that charge.
Ellen.
I think the major amount of discussion we had on that issue was that unmarked gear on the current or the new regs penalty schedule were a level one or level two offense, where the damaging gear was a level one or level four. Now, if you have a lobster trawl with more than four traps, you're going to go over $2,000. So most of the gear damage is probably going to be a level four offense,
where unmarked gear could be a level one. And the discussion we had was that it really should be at an equal point. And I think that we all agreed to that.
Vincent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to talk about the gear conflict issue also. And the way you determine negligence has me really concerned. And I'll tell you why. I fish off the southwest coast of Maine. The lobster traps now go to 100 fathom. There's no question about it. 95% of those dead gears I consider unmarked because it doesn't have radar reflectors and spindlers, high enough spindlers. So you're telling me if I choose to tow around them and I get into one, that is considered negligence?
That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying every case is different, and we're going to look at all the facts and circumstances, and all the considerations that you've raised are relevant to that consideration. If something's not marked in accordance, if gear is not marked in accordance with the law, I can't say that that's negligent.
And I think I'm going to go on some of the stuff that PK was saying. Is the amount of gear that is in the water now compared to just 10 years ago, it's enormous. And they don't set the traditional ways anymore. And another great example is, say you're in 50 fathom of water. Well, they come out with 100 fathom inlines. And what basically happens is you could be, 200 feet away from them. But because of the way the tide's running and the fact that their inlines are so long, you're mm-hmm. still hooking into this gear. So there's just a lot more to this than just gear conflict and rules of engagement, I guess is the best way to put it.
Yeah, and I strongly encourage the council to elaborate on those concerns in its letter so that we are aware of them and we can appropriately take them into consideration when we're considering charging these types of violations. But as I said, I mean, all the facts that we have, we're going to take into consideration.
Lou.
Excuse me. As Ellen said, part of the issue is that unmarked gear has level 1 and 2 as a possibility, and the gear damage has 1 and 4. I think part of that problem is that gear damage is lumped together with stealing, and where you might want to have a level 1 and jump up to level 4 on cases of stealing, I think it's a dollar amount that's involved there. There may be cases where, as Joe said, they use discretion to determine the culpability. But if they're limited by the level they can go to because of this matrix, then they're limited to 2 instead of 4. So possibly if they could split that out and have gear damage, and you could have a range of culpability for that, but for stealing it would still be, it's either a minor case or it's over some dollar limit and you go to level 4.
Derry.
Yeah, so I guess our task is to have the council comment on our comments that we have written in our letter. And, if everybody approves, we send this letter next week to Washington. And I think, all the comments around the table should be incorporated in our letter. Add some things on. That's the way I'm reading it. Add some things on that people have brought up for discussion. Joe's point about how you can hire somebody with a prior responsibly, and because if they're going to keep that policy, we think that it should be eliminated. But if they're going to keep that policy, they should offer some guidance on how we can do it responsibly. That's what I'm hearing. Is that what everybody else is hearing? I guess I'm asking.
Yeah, I want to go. Are there any comments from the audience? Ron.
Ron Smalls, Fishery Survival Fund. I pretty much just have a question. The lobster fishery offshore is controlled by the Atlantic States Marine Fish Commission. They have a regulation that the strings have to be hauled every 30 days. I was just wondering how that's enforced and whether, in fact, there's an accurate assessment of how much fixed gear is out on the fishing grounds. Because when you talk about gear conflict, a lot of it has to do with how much gear is there. And it seems to me there's a lot more gear out there than should be, and a lot of it is not hauled. So I'm just wondering how those regulations are enforced.
Thank you. I'm going to punt on that one. I don't know, and I'll have to powwow with Logan and other folks in OLE and maybe touch base with Ron offline, and we can discuss that.
Okay. Mary Beth.
So just a clarifying question. This issue on the crew, this is a current regulation that, we're commenting on and not part of the new proposed regulations?
Right. The issue regarding imputing priors for vessel operators or crew members who committed violations on different vessels is the current penalty policy. It's been the policy since 2011. The proposed penalty policy proposes to limit the time back we look at someone's priors to 5 years.
Yeah, so we weren't aware of it. And, you know, working for a company that employs, you know, about 100 crew members around the country, it's really rather disconcerting. So, I don't know, maybe I'll have more questions offline.
Tom, and then we're going to try to wrap this.
Yeah, that's all I was going to say is I'm comfortable with the letter as written. I think that Terry's suggestion that we incorporate some of the concerns or points made here at the table and send this out. I think that's what we should do. If you want a motion, or we could do it by consensus, but I think we should send this out, incorporate people's comments here.
Ellen?
I just wanted to elaborate on what Terry said. I think from listening, there's two issues that are not specifically illuminated in the letter, and that is what Joe asked from us is guidance on how we can diligently hire someone with prior violations, and two, to elaborate on the gear conflict concerns that the people around the table have for him in the letter. So those two issues aren't addressed, and those I think should be put in, and if we do it by consensus, we can send it out. Thank you.
Terry, I mean, do you have something to add? Otherwise, I'm going to ask if there's an objection to supplementing the committee's letter. Okay, get it on record.
And yeah. The Heron motion that we made just a few minutes ago, can we add that into the letter?
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure that was it.
Is there an objection? Thank you, Enforcement Committee. Tom, we're going to move right into the your report.
Terry,
thank you.
Terry. We have one motion that we hadn't brought up from the Enforcement Committee, too.
Oh, you have a motion, too? Oh, okay.
Karen's going to put it on the board. This is a committee motion. So the council consider giving the BMS Enforcement Committee the authority to comment on proposed rule regarding gear storage, and specifically to comment to include the yellow mesh in addition to the orange mesh in the additional measures.
You want to provide some rationale, then we're glad to the audience.
Okay. The reason is, we'd like to bring it back before the council, but the comment date runs out a week before our next council meeting, so we were going to have an enforcement committee meeting prior to that and craft a letter, and the timing just didn't work out so that we could bring it back to the council again in June.
Committee motion does not need a second. Anyone from the audience wish to comment? Seeing not, Tom?
So just for clarification, the way we've handled this in the past is what this really means is the Enforcement Committee makes a recommendation to the chair, and the chair forwards it on. The chair is the one who has the responsibility for communicating to the agency.
Further, Mayor Beth.
So with that clarification, that makes perfect sense. Is the motion now correct in giving the authority to the committee, or is it just... It's fine? Okay.
Seeing none, the motion carries. Is there any further business from the Enforcement Committee, Terry?
No, there is not.
All right. Thanks. Now you're on, Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This next item on the agenda is somewhat administrative in nature, but we thought it was an important point to bring the council up to speed on some efforts that have been going on in the background. A few years ago, we got a report that's referred to as the Pate Report or the Touchstone Report, and it had a number of suggestions for improving the council process and the council management system. And buried in that report was a couple suggestions to develop a collaborative process to create, review, and approve rules, fisheries management rules. And so about a year and a half ago, in late 2012, we were wrestling with how to proceed forward on that particular item, and we interpreted rules broadly to mean not just the actual regulations, but the development of management plans. And what we did is a rather unique idea, sort of, is we said, well, let's ask the people who actually do the work on these documents to get together and tell us what might be done to improve the process. So we organized a team, which we picked the rather unoriginal name of the Tiger Team to refer to them, of council, NIMPS, and Science Center staff to take a look at our fisheries management process and make some suggestions on how it could be improved. This group started to meet in early 2013. They continued to meet through the fall, and they prepared a very good and illuminating report, which they delivered to Bill, John, and I, and our appropriate deputies as well in February. And so what we thought we would do is we would ask two of the members of the group here, Pete Christopher from GARFO and Lori of our staff, to give you a short presentation on the work and the results of that particular group. And then afterwards, John, George, and I will address a few comments and make a few comments and then answer any questions if there are any.
Lori.
Okay. Thank you. And we are, Pete and I are just going to very quickly kind of cover some of the main points in the report. As Tom mentioned, this was a collaborative effort that took about a year of meetings to work through. And I believe in the binder, the final report is provided as well as one of the appendices that we developed. So I'm just going to touch on, we're just going to touch on a couple of the issues. In general, the Tiger Team, as Tom mentioned, was put together in response to the Touchstone Report and the need to try to make an effort to improve some of the procedural elements of developing FMP actions. So we worked with a facilitator from SRA, International consulting firm, to develop the recommendations in the report from the Tiger Team. In general, the scope was, as I mentioned, to improve the process of developing FMP actions, but we really focused on improving efficiency, enhancing collaboration, and improving the effectiveness of the development and review process. We went forward into this with several objectives, which included identifying the challenges,